Welcome everyone to this interview where I'm super excited to be talking with Dr. Peter Levine. And we're going to be talking about healing toxic shame. Shame happens within us. It also happens in the dynamics of our relationships. And we'll talk about this from the perspective of trauma, but also how do we heal the shame that so often can be the barriers to connection and intimacy, both in our in intimate relationship, but also in friendships, family, and other relationships as well. To give you a little bit of Peter's background, Peter Levine, PhD, is the developer of somatic experiencing, a naturalistic and neurobiological approach to healing trauma. He holds doctorates in both biophysics and psychology. He's the founder and president of the Ergos Institute for Somatic Education and the founder and advisor for Somatic Experiencing International. Dr. Levine is the author of several best-selling books on trauma, including Waking the Tiger, Healing Trauma, published in over 29 languages. He has received lifetime achievement awards from Psychotherapy Networker and from the U.S. Association for Body-Oriented Psychotherapy. He continues to teach trauma healing workshops internationally. So firstly, Peter, welcome back. I really appreciate you making the time for this conversation. Sure. So you were just saying to me just before we started recording, and I interrupted you because I thought it was the perfect place for us to start in the interview. You were saying that not all relationships that become toxic start that way.
Yeah.
Say more about that.
Well, I think there are a number of things. We all come into relationships with all kinds of expectations and with all kinds of histories. And those histories kind of can rear their ugly head. But what's, I think, even more fundamental is that, most of us really haven't had the gift of being well-regulated as baby infants and babies and children. And without that, things can go from bad to worse. And if couples can learn how to each individual how to regulate themselves to some degree, and also to co-regulate each other, then it's surprisingly, I'm not saying that makes a perfect relationship, but it really gets the relationship on a good, even keel. And so that's one of the things that I don't see private clients anymore, but I think that's one of the things that really gives us a good footing in a relationship and increases our level of care with each other, because we do feel each other's needs for regulation. And in a way, if you think about it, it's a beautiful thing when couples, when they get upset, and instead of attacking each other, can say something, I'm really upset right now. Here's what's going on in my body. I would really appreciate if you could just be here with me while I just kind of move through this and see what's going on. I mean, that's, to me, is a mature relationship.
Yeah, that's of course not what often happens though, right?
No, of course.
So, and going back to what you were saying around the ideal is a relationship is one of the places that provides that regulation for us. Yes. That when we come into a relationship, of course, part of what can be happening is we don't have that regulation inside of us. And so we're in a way looking to that person to provide it. And then when that's not happening, there's a sort of escalation of pushing and pulling. And so you can speak a little bit to how that can be problematic, but also how we can move away from that.
Yeah. Well, I think what happens, like you say, is, or you hint, is that we go into blame and shame. It's your fault. And the other partner says, no, it's your fault. And we feel shamed, and we shame each other. Again, that doesn't help. That doesn't enrich a relationship. Shame is a very tricky emotion, a chronic shame, at least. I mean, there's shame that's really necessary. It's part of the social glue, and it's part of the glue of couples to be able to say, you know, I realized that I was wrong when I said this about you, you know, last week. And I apologize. I really apologize. And something like that can really kind of wipe the slate clean.
Yeah.
So that's healthy shame. But shame and blame is another kind of shame. And that is a toxic shame. And that does then lead to toxic relationships, relationships that may not have started as being toxic, but then soon become toxic and bite on its own tail.
Well, of course, part of the challenge is that typically when we come into new relationship, we are presenting, let's say, the neat and tidier aspects of ourselves, right? And so that mm-hmm. early foundation often is maybe we are quite skillful, at least on the surface, of responding in a helpful way and being patient and being tolerant. And then what often happens over time, in a way, because we feel safe in the relationship, as we start to relax, some of the other elements then start to come in.
I actually hadn't really thought about it that way, but it's a good. I like some of your phrases here, like neat and tidy. You know, we start a relationship, we have all of our hopes, we have, of course, our projections, we have the search for the magical other. And then we find out that this is not the magical other. It's another person with their own flaws, their own challenges. And then we have to really adjust to that reality that the other person is a real person. And what I mean by a real person is that they have their own real issues. And if we can learn to respect those differences and help regulate each other, then we have the opportunity to have a beautiful, enduring, healthy relationship.
What helps us make that transition? So there's the recognition that we're in blame and shame, where we're looking for the other person to meet our needs, but we're not willing to meet their needs, that there's not a reciprocity that's happening there. What helps us, if we find ourselves in that place, what helps us start to move from there?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. So how do we move from reciprocity? I think the first thing is much easier said than done, is we recognize that something's happened and we're feeling stuck. And I think if we can start from that platform, you know, sweetheart, I'm really feeling stuck here. I wonder how you're doing. And so that, again, opens to connection. So yeah, I'm feeling stuck. And which is meaning, you know, I could use some help from you. And how can I be there for you? So to be able to hold those together. Again, I think those are cofactors that play into lasting relationships.
It strikes me, Pisa, the really critical in what you're saying here is that there, in a way, there's the recognition that in those moments of tension or sort of activation that's happening, but actually to really address any issues that are going on, we first have to be in a place of regulation or co-regulation together.
Right.
And I guess often we try to fix the problem from a place that we're not going to be able to really fix the problem.
Right. That's good. I mean, of course, the other thing is, we also bring into the relationship our long history of trauma, abuse, neglect, and how that plays itself out. You know, I was just thinking about a couple that I saw, must have been 40 plus years ago. And a colleague of mine who was a marriage family therapist she asked me to see this couple to see what I could do, because she was just unable to work with them, and she was just, you know, really frustrated. So anyhow, they came into my office, and I had the obligatory couch, and they both sat down on the couch, completely on the opposite side, as far away as it could possibly. I mean, I'm sure a marriage therapist will, you know, recognize this. And so I'm thinking, okay, so where do I go from here? Where do I go from here? And I noticed something interesting. They both had a scar across their throat. And I thought, that's interesting. So maybe they have, they've had thyroid problems and had, you know, had thyroid surgery together. When I kind of brought the topic up, they froze. And so then I realized, oh, okay, we have trauma coming up here. We need to find out what that trauma is. Well, what I uncovered with them is that they were driving their VW bus, somebody was hitchhiking on the road. So they picked up the person, and he was in the back. And then, I mean, this is actually bizarre, but so it is what happened. So prepare yourself for it. The man had an enormous knife, and he slit both of their throats. Miraculously, they were right outside of a hospital emergency room, so they were able to save their lives. So I said, look, I need to work with you one at a time. So the one that I'm not working with, just stay here and just see if you can be aware of what happens to you when you're seeing your mate work with me. And so, of course, I've worked with both of them around that horrific trauma. And then it was wonderful. As they resolved the trauma, they worked through the trauma, starting from the opposite sides of the couch to become closer and closer, and, closer. Wow. And then holding hands. And then I gave them some tools for helping to regulate. Because, I mean, when you have a trauma like this, it's not like it completely goes away completely. But in times of stress, in times of activation, it may come up again. So to be aware of that and aware of what they can do so they're not helplessly floundering, with the trauma. And I didn't say anything to my colleague. And so I got a call a couple of days later, and she said, Peter, I don't know what you did, but I don't have any more work to do.
It's so interesting though, isn't it? Because in a way, in this, what you're describing is the freeze had become like a wall between them. Like it had, yeah, it caused a disconnect, but it's like but also it strikes me that sometimes just the journey of doing inner work together also becomes a connecting thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, again, to me, that's when the relationship becomes a growth relationship. When you're working together, working with each other, supporting each other. And the more we can learn to do that, the less that we're swept off our feet when these difficult emotions and sensations become activated. I don't know if I'm being repetitious here, but I mean, I think it bears repetition because it's so important in relationships and such a great opportunity. I mean, if you think a relationship is going to solve all your problems, well, I mean, good luck. But at the same time, it can be really, can be a step in healing some of our deep wounds and learning to be fully connected. Yeah.
Of course, one of the frustrations that people can have is that they're in a relationship with someone, a bit like the couple you described, that are on the couch, which have sort of got that proverbial kind of wall between them. And one part is willing and keen to do the work. And another is not necessarily that they're not ultimately willing, but there's a lot of defensive structure that's built up that's in the way. That can be difficult, right? Because there's the potential, but there's not that reciprocity in that work.
You know, it's interesting. I think sometimes couples come together and one couple is very much therapeutically minded, but the other isn't. And often those relationships will fall apart because of that. But if you recognize that, and as a request from the one person to the other, to be able to say, you know, I really feel that for us to continue and to grow together, you know, I would hope that you would start to do some therapeutic work yourself. And I know I can't push you to do it. That's your choice. But if you could do that, it would make a big difference for me. And again, you're saying, you put it as an appreciation rather than you should do this, that you don't have enough therapy and I'm the only one who has therapy. I think you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's funny. Megan, who's my co-host in these conferences, and I have got this joke that we realize that pretty much, and I think we've both put ourselves in this category as well, that pretty much everyone that's gone to couples work has gone to couples work so the therapist can tell their other half why they need to change, right? Very few people that go to couples work because they want to do the work.
Well, seen that one, done that one.
So I want to come back to this topic of shame, because it feels that it to me that it's, in a way, it's multi-layered. There's the shame, there's the blaming and shaming of other people, but also as we get closer to our own work and we get close particularly to our own sort of stored trauma, there's often also a layer of shame that's in there as well, right? And that's often, that can be one of the barriers in relationship to going to these vulnerable places, not just the externalized shame, but also the internal.
Absolutely. I mean, shame is probably the most difficult of all emotions to work with, maybe more difficult than fear or even rage, because it just sucks our energy out of us. And it's something that really needs to be worked with therapeutically. I mean, I'm not saying it's impossible, but I rarely see couples able to work through their shared shame issues without some outside help. So I think that's another important thing about couples work, is to know when individual work is absolutely necessary to continue on.
What do you see as the relationship between shame and defensiveness? I'm going to put it in a bit of a personal if my wife was here now and you were to say to her, what's the thing that Alex most needs to work on in relationship, I can guess you'd probably say being defensive. And so it's like, get called out on something, first response is to defend. Well, and in a way, the layer above that is often this kind of shame layer. I'm curious as to your thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, I think we're defensive as a way of trying to protect ourselves from not feeling the shame.
Right.
And so I think that's important to realize what we're defending against. And again, in this case, it's shame. And in very many cases, it's also shame.
Yeah. And I guess also, as I'm sort of reflecting personally, it's like, it's often a projected shame, right? Like, so I can recognize my wife might say something, which is a relatively reasonable comment, but I'm projecting shame onto it. So what I'm hearing is different to what's being said. And so in a way, it's like our inner shame we then see in the world around us.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, we see through those glasses.
Right.
Shame everything. And, you know, and again, shame just is the ugliest of all the emotions, chronic shame. And as I said, we will do almost anything to avoid it. And also, to then avoid contact with our partner, you know, because being with them is evoking the shame. So I think the first thing that couples need to learn to do is to identify each one to identify when they're in shame.
Right.
And then to make note of that, you know, and take it into the therapist. As I say, you know, I think a lot of work people can do with each other in couples, but shame is really not one of them and really needs somebody, some guidance in that. It doesn't mean you have to take, you know, years and years of therapy, but to just find somebody that you can work with this particular issue and then bring it back into the relationship.
And what would be some of the pieces that would be helpful in that shame work? So if someone's working with what might help move through that?
Okay. Again, first of all, identifying it. I found in working with shame before I even knew it was shame, like for the past half century, is that there's a specific bodily posture of shame. And that's what keeps the shame circulating. It keeps circulating the content. But what really is the anchor of that is the bodily posture. So for example, if you think about that, when we're feeling shame, what people will do, not only people, but for example, dogs and other mammals probably, is we turn away from the person and look down to break the contact. And then we kind of collapse forward like this. And that just takes the energy out of us because it's the collapse. It's the hypo arousal state. And so when I'm able to help people notice the posture, and instead of just going into the posture like this, to just touch into the posture that's the smallest amount like this titration, and then slowly coming back up. And usually what happens is when they come up, they start feeling a lengthening in their spine and the beginning of pride and dignity. So to go from shame to pride to dignity is the way out of shame. So again, just having the person just notice, averting the gaze, looking down, slowly, slowly coming forward, just the smallest amount. It feels horrible, but then coming back out, feeling the spine lengthening, feeling the chest opening, and feeling return to pride and dignity. And that's much better to lead a relationship when you're experiencing pride and dignity and respect the other person's pride and dignity. So that's one of the hints in working with shame and shame trauma, is to learn how to work with the posture, because that's what keeps recirculating the whole shame complex.
Of course, one of the challenges can be that we get so normalized to going to these places that we often may not recognize we're doing it. And I guess that's one of the real gifts, going back to what you were saying a little bit earlier about how loving relationship can be a support, because if the other person can help recognize that there's been that sort of collapse and turning away that's happened, you actually name it.
Yeah, you know. And then to be able to say something like, oh, dear, oh, sweetheart, it seems like what I did was kind of activating some shame. And I apologize for that. And is there any way I can be here for you? Think about that. What a difference that would make.
Wow.
Instead of shaming the shame.
Well, I think what strikes me as being particularly powerful about that is that in the place of shame, often in a way, we're rejecting others before they reject us, because there's this sort of sense of not being lovable. Mm-hmm. So actually being met in that place, like being met with kindness and softness, even in that place, feels a powerful thing.
It really is. And it's really about vulnerability on both people's part. You know, the person who's experiencing the shame of being vulnerable enough to identify it, and the other couple who is able to say, to not be defensive and to say, oh, sweetheart, again, I'm sorry if you know, if what I said made you feel shame, excuse me. Oh, I have a sneeze.
Bless you.
I came back with a cold yesterday.
Oh, bless you. Yeah, so.
I mean, that's to me what a healthy relationship is. And you could say a toxic relationship is the opposite of that, is when this doesn't happen.
Right. Well, that's what is in my mind, because in a way, it's like, I think it's really helpful to paint the picture of what's possible. And then there's the reality of where people can find themselves. And then there's how, and I really like that practical suggestion around using posture and around if there's in that place, just sort of titrating that edge and then finding the way back from it. I'm wondering what else, when we're in those sort of shame dynamic, because the other thing that we were going back to a bit, what we said earlier about the shame and blame game, it also goes back and forth, right? Like, so there's a kind of escalating that happens. But what can help? And I'm thinking also not just in intimate relationship here, but also, you know, wider family relationships, particularly, you know, parent, child, sibling, when we're in those places of sort of, you know, shame's going back and forth, and maybe particularly when we haven't got the loving container of intimate relationship, it's a bit less well held. What can help us move with that in a different way?
Well, again, I think the first thing is to recognize it.
Yeah.
And usually we don't know what it is, but we just feel, all of a sudden we feel yuck.
Technical term,
and again, if we can be vulnerable around that in ourselves and say, you know, I don't know what just happened, you know, it's like I just shut down and I went away from you, you know, I'd like to see if we can find a way back into connection, because that's what people are seeking. Two things: connection and safety and connection.
And of course, the more that we find ourselves in that shame dynamic, in a way, it feels like it's almost, I'm thinking out loud, it's almost impossible to be in safe connection when there's shame in the middle of it.
Yeah, sure. No, absolutely. Absolutely. But at least if you recognize it, then you know what the next steps might be.
Yes.
But for sure, just recognizing it isn't going to make it disappear. But it can give you a little bit of a ground to stand on.
Yeah. Yeah. What might be the next step? So we're at, let's take a working example that we've got, let's say, a situation with, you know, a sibling or you know, mom and dad, where it's not a super close relationship, but it's a relationship that still matters, and we want to stay in relationship with that person. It's not so bad that the actual resolution is to separate. So we recognize that's happening. I guess part of it is also a sort of trying to use tools we may have to settle a bit more in ourselves and not get pulled into the activation. What else can we do?
Well, it very often does occur in friendships, actually. And, you know, I think one of the places, I don't think I'm going to answer your question quite yet, but it particularly is true of adolescence.
Yeah.
And particularly the shaming that young women do to each other. You know, it's this kind of thing like you're best friends with somebody, you know, best friends, and you text each other 100 times a day and blah, 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 blah. And then one day you go to school and the person doesn't have anything to do with you, won't have anything to do with you. They say, you know, this is my new best friend. And
that this Peter is my 12-year-old daughter's life right now.
12-year-old daughter, yes. Well, let me know what you find out that helps.
Bless you. I was hoping you might have the answer.
But I have some hints there I can give. But it's, you know, and it feels like death.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, well, why is it so powerful? Shame, death. I mean, that just way out of proportion. But if you think about this, and this is true of primate groupings, you know, if if one of the members is ostracized because they're doing some behavior that's not acceptable, in other words, they're being shamed, and they're thrown out from the tribe, and if they don't, and they often are unable to find another group to connect with, they will die. And so that's, I think, my background is in studying ethology, animal behavior, and so forth. But I really think that that's the relationship that actually goes on, and that it's why it feels so absolutely horrible. Feels like I will not survive it, that I'll die. And you think about that when your daughters come home and they're just bereft with grief.
Yeah.
And so what can we do as parents? Again, I'm waiting for you, but I think one of the things...
Please keep talking.
I think one of the things is saying, sweetheart, I know this feels really horrible. And you know what? Probably next week, you're going to be her best friend again, or you're going to find another best friend. And I know it feels so hard, but believe me, it will pass. This too shall pass. So hearing that from a parent, especially from a father, I think, really, really makes a big, big difference, and gives the daughter some hope, that this is not the end of the world.
But what's, I think, also really important in what you're saying is that what you just described to me was a beautiful example of holding someone where they are, giving them hope for the future, but not shaming them in their experience.
That's right.
That you can hold someone, offer hope, but not from a place of shame.
Yeah, obviously, the one thing you don't want to do with your daughter is saying, look, you'll get over it.
Exactly. Doesn't work. I've tried it.
Then you're in shame.
Exactly.
And then you have to say, God, I can't believe I just said that.
Exactly. Exactly that.
Must be my own stuff. But yeah. I mean, these things change, and they feel like the air has gone out of you.
I think it's also, one of the things that I think is often tricky for people when they do their inner work and start to have new perspectives, new understandings, start to put some boundaries in place, things start to progress and move forwards. But some of those relationships, which are really precious and important, inevitably the dynamic starts to change because we're starting to put certain things maybe we tolerated in the past. We're now saying, please don't talk to me that way. Actually, that really isn't okay for me. Or we're recognizing that perhaps with our parents, that there are dynamics in there, which are the source of some of the suffering we're trying to work on. And we don't want to shame them, but also need to reestablish that.
Good point. I mean, it's also about boundaries, and I'm not saying it's going to be easy to do, but if your daughter is able to say, okay, look, that's your thing. And boundaries in general, again, that's, I think, one of the important antidotes of not being shamed is being able to set boundaries. And now again, how do you set boundaries? Well, in working with people for good while, therapists refer clients that have issues around boundaries. And so they role play, they psychodrama, they coach the client, to keep the boundary with their spouse or the tradesperson who's coming in, the plumber who's coming in or something like that. But then they think, okay, that's good. They're going to be fine. But then something happens and the whole thing collapses again. I can just think of so many examples of that. And again, from where I stand from as a body therapist, it is about, until you get boundaries felt in the body, then you're not really able to set them and maintain them. So, for example, when I do an exercise with the VU and the jaw, and also with my hand and arms going like VU. So you feel the power and you feel how your body naturally wants to make a boundary, form a boundary. And once you've practiced it physically, physiologically, and physically, then it becomes so much easier to actually do it when it comes up in, you know, in your life. So again, boundaries are absolutely essential in relationships. Because if you're unable to set boundaries, and that doesn't mean you walk all over the other person, but they're going to wind up walking over you, or you're going to experience them as walking over you. So working with both, I've done that again with couples, have them both feel the boundaries and then face each other and then do the boundary exercise with each other. And typically they'll just start laughing.
Yeah, I can imagine that. But it also, when what we're longing for and yearning for is co-regulation. Mm-hmm. And let's say we're in regulation with someone, but the dynamic's toxic. And so to find the place of balance, we're mm-hmm. going to have to push that person. We're going to have to break the regulation to reset the boundary.
Yeah.
And so in, way, yeah. in the short term, we're losing the connection.
Uh-huh.
It's a tricky one, isn't it?
It sure is. You definitely got me thinking on this one. You know, again, when each person, each individual in the relationship is able to say, I need to pull back. I need to pull back. I'm not, you know, and let's maybe just come together in an hour or so, or tomorrow. You know, let's both feel what's going on in ourselves, see how we've contributed and what we might do to help change it. But then don't try to do it when everybody is in the activated state. But I think that's a very difficult one, especially where one or both people have abandonment fear, you know, because if we say, well, let's come back tomorrow, it's like there may never be a tomorrow. It right. feels like that, right? I mean, obviously it's not like that. And each time you do that, the relationship actually feels more and more secure, you know. And so you can trust that if one or both of us needs some of our own space right now, it's okay to take it, and the relationship will survive it, and very often survive and thrive.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because it's that balance in relationship of, let's say we're in relationship with someone that we know they have an anxious attachment style, for example. And so they need that sort of constant reassurance and so on. Yeah. But actually, in a way, we're in danger of enabling that issue. And so there's a kind of place of holding that person, but also not trapping that person in that place. Yeah. And I think that's also, it's a tricky edge to find.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, you're answering these dandy questions. You know, I think in some ways, attachment has become the end all for relationship problems. And obviously, attachment issues play out in relationships. But I think if we're just looking at that, we may be missing some of the other things that are going on in the relationships, such as learning how, when, and how to co-regulate each other. You know, because in a way, until we can regulate, be co-regulated and regulate ourselves, that we keep falling into these attachment black holes.
Yeah, that's a good word for it. Yeah, a good word for it. It's like in a way, what you're saying is, rather than over focusing on the fact that someone's anxious or avoidant, whatever, to focus on, well, how do we cultivate a secure attachment? Like, and if we can
build
that, yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's, again, if a couple is committed to doing that and to being there for each other, when they do that, that couple, as I said, will thrive. you know, and then that relationship will be very important. And a lot of times, problems which people have thought was from some other source in relationships, really, once you're able to capture the regulation piece, that a lot of these other issues kind of can fall into place.
Yeah, in a way, what you're saying is we can constantly focus on trying to fix the problem, or we can put our energy towards what we actually want to build together.
That's right. That's right. To look not just to the past, but to look to the present, to look to the future from the present.
Yeah. Yeah. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. I think we're pretty much out of time, but that was like a really nice place. But do you want to say a few words about the programs? I know that there's a substantive, obviously, body of work between your books and online courses. And
those
things. So, but do you want to just speak a little bit?
Thank
so
you.
People
Thank
can go
you.
Deeper. Yeah.
Actually, some time ago, about a year or so ago, one of my really dear friends said, you know, well, what I was noticing is I was really revisiting and kind of sorting through the index cards of my life. And it was very deep excavation for me. And one of my friends said, you know, you really should write this as a book. And I said, no way. No way. And as it turns out, I did write it as a book. And it is called An Autobiography of Trauma, A Healing Journey. And you can get it now on Amazon. It's now available to pre-order on Amazon. And it's something like the first time when I thought about, you know, writing it as a book, I froze, to talk about freezing. And fortunately, a friend was there with me, and she just said, that's okay, let's just settle with that. But then I had the following dream. I had in my hands a whole ream of pages in each hand. And I was facing into an open meadow. And I was, obviously, I didn't know what to do. And then all of a sudden, this wind came from behind me and took all the pages and just threw them out into the wind, land where they may. And that's when I decided that I would put this down as a book, as an autobiography, and with the hope, and I think there's some indication that it does help with this, is to help people with their own healing. And to tell my story. And much of these are things that people have never known about me. So again, if you go to Amazon and order it, that will actually help, whatever you call it, when they have a thing where it, you know, if you order it, then it connects to other things.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyhow, so that's the new thing with me. Also, I believe it's in March that we're having a retreat in Costa Rica. And we do this once or twice a year, and it's with a small number of people. And as you know, we just did one at Broughton Hall. And that one was just profoundly transformative, I think, for all the people that were in it. And
yeah,
I do
I heard that,
a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I do that with a group of my SE teachers and assistants, and it's kind of it's a whole kind of progression of things. And this one had to do more with developmental trauma and with ancestors, connection with our ancestors. So anyhow, Costa Rica will be coming up next. And if you go to somaticexperiencing.com, you can find out about that.
And I also see there's a conference apparently coming up with Bessel and Gabor and some other speakers early next year as well. But I think people will find everything in time at your website, somaticexperiencing.com.
That's right. That's right. Yep.
Wonderful. Peter, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. I really enjoyed that.